Ladies and gentlemen, this opening slide really demonstrates one of the reasons why we're here today to talk about this topic. In China, you've got a booming automobile industry. When you talk to automobile executives around the world and you say, where are the bright spots internationally for the development of your industry? It's China. There may be other parts of Asia, India, Southeast Asia, that also have huge growth potential, but it's pretty much a China story. And you walk through Chinese automobile manufacturing plants, whether they be foreign invested or domestically owned facilities, and you tend to see state-of-the-art operations. Sadly, on the other side of the equation, as we all know, General Motors now, which was once the largest vehicle manufacturer in the world, is now in bankruptcy, and the fortunes of many of the international players in this area have taken a turn for the worse. And so we see in very sharp contrast how one particular industry tends to highlight some of the issues that we'll be talking about this morning. Now, when we talk about any impact on China, or when we talk about China at all, one of the questions that always comes up is, what China are we talking about? I've spent most of my time in China, in Beijing, which is a very exciting, modern, diverse city. Yet our mine sites are located in parts of the country in which you would say modernity really hasn't turned around the corner yet, parts of the country that are still quite impoverished and reflect a lifestyle that probably is more or less interrupted for centuries. And so I think as we talk about China today, and you'll hear me generalize a lot about what's going on in China and some of the activities that the Chinese government has initiated, we need to be careful to remember that there are really many, many different Chinas, and both the activities and their impact will be different around the country, and certainly be different on different segments of the population, because we're really talking about a country that is still very much characterized by very, very significant internal contrasts. As you can see in the image on the screen, this would be a site that you could see anywhere around the country where Chinese citizens are moving their belongings around in one of the most traditional forms of transport. Yet at the same time, for those of you who have been to Shanghai, you've probably had a chance to ride on one of the most modern forms of transport. The magnetic levitation train is the only such example of that technology in commercial operation. It goes from zero to a heart-throbbing 437 kilometers an hour. It's a magnificent piece of craftsmanship and technology, and a far cry from those traditional forms of transport. You have millions of people who still live in housing that has probably been unchanged for centuries, having a good life, but a pretty basic life. And yet you have millions of people who live in high-rise developments in the major cities and around the coastal areas, with all of the modern conveniences that would be at home in here in Perth, New York, Paris, or other places. On a daily basis throughout China, you have people who bring their goods to the marketplace in a traditional way that has been unchanged for centuries. And at the same time, you have some of the most modern and exciting emporiums anywhere in the world, as this photo of Shanghai demonstrates. You have people whose livelihood has more or less remained the same for many centuries. And then you have factories that really represent international best practice. And you'd be hard-pressed to find better factories anywhere in the world. As I was looking at this picture, by the way, I realized that even this picture, as impressive as it looks, is out of date, because you would go into any similar facility in China today and they'd be full of mechanical robots doing many of the tasks that used to be performed by human labor. You move from traditional villages that are beautiful and quaint But again, more or less unchanged, and there would be hundreds of millions of people who live in settings like this. To 21st century cities that have been designed and built with an infrastructure that would be unparalleled anywhere else in the world. You move from the chairman of the revolution to the chairman of the board, representing a very, very significant shift in the way the country is governed. And so I put these images on the screen because I want us to remember that for all the things we talk about here today, we're really talking about many different types of experiences in China, and it is very difficult to talk about one or two experiences that apply across the board. Now, many of this would be, much of this information would be known to some of you, but I'll run through it real quickly in any event, because why are we talking about China today? Why aren't we talking about Vietnam? Why aren't we talking about Indonesia? Both of these countries are close neighbors of ours. They have very strong growth rates this year. They defy the international trends in terms of what's happening in their economies. But the reason we're talking about China and not Vietnam or Indonesia or many other significant neighbors of ours is because China itself has really become important to the world economy. Three out of the five largest banks in the world are Chinese. I wouldn't have guessed that 5 years ago or 10 years ago. Sinopec is the largest company in the world by market capitalization. China is regarded as having the world's third largest economy now. And I can remember even just 7 or 8 years ago people predicting, well, it might be another 20 years before China got up to the top one, two, or three slot. And they've defied everybody's expectations. And China has the fourth largest stock exchange in the world. And that's a stock exchange that still doesn't allow foreigners or international companies to list their shares. So there's a whole potential group of participants in the stock exchange who are not already included. There's a waiting list of 32 companies who have been previously approved but just waiting in the queue to list approximately 14 billion shares in new IPOs on the Shanghai and Shenzhen stock exchanges. It may be fourth largest right now, but it's not going to be fourth largest for very long. It will overtake at least number two and three very, very soon. And why is China of interest to Australia? Why are we talking about this issue in the context of our own economic welfare? Well, Helen mentioned a few statistics, and Duncan will have some other relevant facts for you later. But just suffice it to say that depending on whose statistics you use and how they cut the numbers, China is either our first or second largest trading and investment partner right now. Again, it's taken that position at a rate much faster than anybody would have predicted. And we've seen enormous benefits domestically to our resources, education, and tourism industries, just to name a few. The Australia-China Business Council, represented by Duncan today, commissioned two studies late last year on the impact of our trade and investment relationship with China. And one of the studies concluded that the average Australian household benefits to the tune of about $3,400 per year as a result of our trade and investment with China. And that would be benefits that include everything from being able to purchase a wider variety of goods for lower products, as well as the impacts that we indirectly benefit from through the contributions to the tax base, employment base, et cetera, related to China trade. And then perhaps most significantly, I think, in terms of our forward-looking analysis, the Reserve Bank of Australia has clearly come out and said that based on its own study, our own economic livelihood, our ability to weather the international global financial crisis, and our own economic prosperity is clearly linked to China. although I think many people in the room and certainly myself have taken that as a almost an article of faith, it is good to hear the Reserve Bank confirm that. So let's just look for a second at what China's stimulus package comprises. China, like the rest of the world, has moved very, very quickly in order to put together a package of incentives and activities that will hopefully stimulate economic activity. And what are they trying to address? Well, I think in the initial stages, what they were trying to address was approximately 20 million people who were out of work in a very short period of time as a result of closures of factories manufacturing goods largely for export. I was talking to some provincial officials in Shandong province in the on the east northeast coast of China a couple of months ago, and they said that within their own little section of that province, they could name or identify some 200 factories which in the previous 3 months had just padlocked the gates. The owners had walked away, usually to other Asian countries. I don't want to slander anybody here. And left their workers unpaid, didn't go through the process of liquidating or winding up the companies. And the millions of workers who've been employed in these factories, either returning to their homes in the countryside or moving back to the urban areas that they originally came from, create a huge economic and social issue for the government. So the stimulus package, I think, in part has tried to create new employment opportunities for this and other groups of people who may have been impacted from the reduction in the export trade. There's been about 4 trillion yuan marked for various stimulus projects. About 75% of that is earmarked to go into infrastructure. So this means bridges, highways, roads, public buildings around the country. Everywhere you go, you can see projects that are underway in the infrastructure area. Excuse me. Interesting. China has come up with its own version of the $900 stimulus check that our government has initiated here. As you go around the country, many large municipalities have been printing and distributing cash coupons. So I think Hangzhou was the first, but you've seen it replicated around the country. And these are coupons that are issued to citizens that they can exchange for goods and services at businesses within that municipality. Now the real kicker here is that they've all got expiration deadlines on them. So the idea is that the government wants you to take your coupon and use it within the next month or 2 months. And so people are running out and buying washing machines and refrigerators and TVs and air conditioners and things like that. And it is having a very definite impact on local consumption. New vehicle taxes have been cut. And as we'll see in a moment, vehicle sales have increased. Bank lending has been encouraged. And as many of you who've worked in China would appreciate, if the government sort of let its controls up on lending in the first quarter of this year just a little bit. And before you knew it, the floodgates were opened. And in the first 3 months of this year, the entire annual quota for lending funds had already been committed in the first 3 months. And so you found businesses around the country all of a sudden saying, well, hold on a second. We had our loan approved last year, but we actually can't get cash now because the banks are giving out too much of it. They just don't have access to the funds. That's been controlled a little bit now. But there was an enormous injection of funding into the economy in the first couple of months of the year. Now, what is all this infrastructure about? I mentioned roads and bridges and so forth. The bridge that you see on the screen is an example of infrastructure that is has been constructed in the province where we have our first gold mine in Guizhou province. It is a bridge which has been under construction for the last 2 years. It's the Baling Bridge. It's about 2.5 kilometers long. It is an impressive piece of engineering. As we would drive out to the mine site for the first year and a half, you'd sort of snake down through this valley and see these towers going up and this suspension coming across. And you thought to yourself, wow, where is that bridge taking people? This is just one small example of the type of infrastructure that has received either new or additional funding in the stimulus package. And what we're finding is that construction has been accelerated. A lot of the feeder roads around this bridge are being constructed now. And in fact, what the Chinese are trying to do, what the government is trying to do, is they've got about 20 years worth of infrastructure development that they're trying to accelerate with the stimulus package. When I see projects like this, I'm reminded of the interstate freeway system in the United States, which from the 50s right up through the early 80s was under construction. And during the 70s in particular, I can recall in the Midwest and the U.S., you could go on these interstate highways and there wouldn't be anybody on them. There were no cars. There were these beautiful state-of-the-art freeways, but no traffic. And today they're all full of traffic, you know, creating commerce and business activity. And that's what the leadership in China is looking for on a quicker rather than slower pace. This is a photo of our mine site at Jinfeng on the other end of that bridge, about 2.5 hours away. It's one of the most impoverished counties in the country. That bridge will bring goods and services to that county in a way that our mine site individually has been unable to do. We make huge economic contributions, but the long-term development of this region as a result of that bridge and other infrastructure is just astounding. It's still early days yet, but what's the impact of all of this? Well, we know that urban fixed asset investment is up about 26%. Car sales, as I mentioned, are up a modest amount, 4%. The government reports that they've built approximately 20,000 kilometers of new roads. I'm assuming that some of those roads probably aren't, fully paved roads with a high number like that. And between the World Bank and some of the investment houses, growth is predicted in China this year of between 7.5% to 8.5%. They'll probably make it and might even exceed it. Power generation is up. All of the transport industries, meaning moving goods and people from one point to the next, are up. And probably the most important thing is business confidence is up. In fact, it's very rarely dipped over the last 18 months. There was a poll last month amongst business people in about 15 countries, and in all of the Western economies, the business people who were polled, the overwhelming majority of them said their economies were either getting worse or would probably get worse, and they had no confidence for the future. By contrast, China was one of the only places in the world where business people were highly confident and quite certain that their own economy was strong and that it was getting stronger. For those of you who are in business, you know that people do not create new economic activity unless they have confidence in the economy. Now, some of the longer-term consequences of all this activity, I think, are still in play at this point. We see many of the dynamics that have been characteristic of the reform process over the last 30 years intensified a bit throughout this economic crisis. You have the state sector competing with the private sector. By some accounts, some 90% of all of the stimulus funds that have been allocated to infrastructure so far have gone to state-owned enterprises, not to private enterprises. You have urban areas where there's a great concern about unemployment, competing with rural areas where the infrastructure is very severely needed. And you have reformers, people who have been championing the opening of the economy, competing with conservatives. And the conservatives are saying, see all this nonsense going on out there? We shouldn't have opened in the first place. We wouldn't have been subject to all of this. It's time to now slow down a bit. And at the same time, the reformers are saying we're stronger today as a result of the opening that we did 10, 15, and 20 years ago. And we're going to see that dynamic, I think, intensify over the next months and years. It's quite interesting that in hearing the CEOs of a few state-owned enterprises talk over the last couple of months, what are they all doing right now? Well, a number of them have said that because of their state ownership, they've been prohibited from laying off workers. So if you've got 10,000 workers, the government has quietly said, you know, please don't lay anybody off. Just sort of keep the numbers steady. What have they been doing with those workers at this time? Well, they've been retraining them. And some of the training programs that I've heard about that these state-owned enterprises have been engaged in, where they're taking workers and taking this time, this downtime, to teach them new skills, new technologies, so that they're well-placed to take their particular companies into a new place in the market when things heat up again, I think will pay very, very significant benefits down the road. So we're seeing some very interesting dynamics. I personally believe that we're going to see China emerge from this process in a stronger, more competitive condition. We're very fortunate here in Australia that our own relationship with China is on a very firm foundation, that we have plenty of growth and potential ahead of us. I'll hold my comments there for the moment and turn it over to Helen. Thank you very much.